Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. She was a warrior for neighborhoods who stopped highways from piercing through lower Manhattan in the 1950s. Jane Jacobs was a self-taught city planner whose activism and research helped change the course of American urban development and redefine what it means for a great city to be great. We'll examine the roots and ramifications of Jacobs' community-centered vision of urbanism with Robert Canigal, the author of Eyes on the Street, The Life of Jane Jacobs. We'll be joined by Ed Guntz, the former architecture critic for the Baltimore Sun, who now covers development for the Baltimore Brew. The city council gave final approval to the bond deal for Port Covington last night. How will Jane Jacobs' ideas about cities and the people who populate them inform our understanding of the many ways this massive project will impact the look and the life of our city? Midday starts right after these headlines. And welcome, everybody, to Midday here on 88.1 WIPR. Glad you are spending part of your day with us. I'm Tom Hall. The renowned urban planner and visionary Jane Jacobs was one of the most influential thinkers about cities and how the people who populate them operate organically, randomly, and vibrantly. She thought about why it is that some neighborhoods thrive and others wither on the vine. She thought about what makes great cities be so great. Jacobs wrote 7 books, and one of them, published in 1961, changed forever the way people think about and envision the built environment of cities and how people interact with that environment and with each other. It's called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, and in a new biography of Jane Jacobs, Baltimore-based author Robert Canigal explores why that book has been so significant and how Jacobs often startled architects, planners, and even economists with her wholly original and radical ideas. It's called Eyes on the Street, The Life of Jane Jacobs, and Robert Canigal joins me today in Studio A. Robert, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming.
I'm glad to be here.
And I really enjoyed the book. She's a fascinating figure. I can't say I knew much about her at all before I read the book. One of the things you do is you draw a parallel between two other very well-known writers, Betty Friedan, who wrote The Feminine Mystique, and Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, right around the time that Jane Jacobs came out with Death and Life of Great American Cities. Interesting that none of these people, including Miss Jacobs, were formally trained in the subjects they were writing about. She was just a sort of a really incredible raw intellect and talent, wasn't she?
The three of them were writers. They were professional writers, and they explored the territories that they made famous, and part of the way they had a hold on people is through the excellence of their language.
What about the fact that they happen to be women? I mean, how much is Miss Jacobs' gender an influence and an informative thing about
at the time? At the time the book came out, I think she encountered some flack. It was very easy to picture her as just a local housewife when she was nothing of the sort. She was a fully professional woman. She was a professional writer more than a professional architect or planner, obviously. But she was excellent in her own sphere. She worked for Architectural Forum magazine, one of the Time Life magazines. But some of the criticism was aimed at the fact that, what is this person who hasn't even been to college? She's a woman she's a mother of three. What does she know? What can she tell us?
Right.
And in fact, she told us a great deal.
Yeah, in 1961, a mother of three. You know, mm-hmm. you have a very certain notion of what that person is. You have a great anecdote in the book. In 1980, she was in Faneuil Hall in Boston with James Rouse, whom folks in Maryland know a lot about, the developer of, you know, Columbia and the Inner Harbor. And Rouse invoked at this forum they were at, a dictum made famous by Daniel Burnham that says, make no little plans, they have no magic to stir men's blood. And then Jane Jacobs got up and said, I'm not sure big plans ever did have the magic to stir women's blood. I think that was a great anecdote.
One of the points that Jane made all along is that we think of cities as the big city, and we think of it as a question of scale. The city is a big thing, but she emphasized again and again that the way to think of cities is to think of cities in the small. what's happening on in a particular neighborhood, what's happening on a block, what are the personal relationships between the people who live here and the people who live up and down the block.
The influence of this book, and she wrote many other books besides The Death and Life of Great American Cities, but the influence really cannot be understated. I mean, in what ways was it so significant?
It happened gradually, I think. When the book first came out, the reactions to it were both wildly positive and wildly negative. One of them said that if she had written this book in the Middle Ages, she would have been burned as a witch, because this was such an affront to all the established notions of the way the built environment that people are supposed to like is. This, remember, is a time, the post-war world, where the whole emphasis was on moving out to the suburbs, moving out to spacious, green, serene places. And if you didn't have that as part of your DNA, if you were somehow attracted to the livelihood, the liveliness of cities, you sort of felt a little bit weird. And Jane Jacobs' book came along, and at the very least it did, is legitimize living in cities, that cities can be a good way to live in a different way from the suburbs, where the emphasis is not greenery and serenity and peace, but on liveliness and diversity and activity.
And this, as you say, the zeitgeist, she was really sort of going against the zeitgeist, wasn't she? Because this is, you know, post-Eisenhower, a time when America was building expressways. Mm-hmm. So the landscape was, you know, full of these long, long, fast roads with cloverleaf exit and on-ramps. And she's bringing it back home to the mm-hmm. cities, which is, of course, where the immigrants of the early 1900s, you know, all congregated first. So it's interesting that was she a lone voice in the woods about this? Was she the only person talking about cities? Because certainly cities were populated. I mean, they mm-hmm. were in many cases still overcrowded.
But I think there was a almost universal feeling among anybody. Maybe they didn't subject to active thinking, but it was a universal assumption that the cities are our old history, that what we need to do is find new ways for people to live, and these are basically those of the suburbs. And the emphasis was on splitting up commercial areas, residential areas, industrial areas. People just took that for granted. And Jane, who lived in the West Village of New York City, in Greenwich Village, saw people walking across her streets over to the docks on the Hudson River. There were longshoremen there. There were the kids. There were people who lived there. There was this whole mixing, and she saw a tremendous vitality right in front of her door.
Is it that experience, the fact that she was living in the West Village, she was a city person, although she grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I mean, she did not grow up in a large city. But at that point, she had moved to New York. She did a bunch of sort of small clerical odd jobs and then started working as a journalist. Is that what got her involved in urban planning? Because as we said, she was not formally trained as an architect or an urban planner. How did she had written about a bunch of other subjects prior to writing this book.
I think people sometimes forget that she was really, before the city work, she was a generalist. She was a writer. She was an expert in laying words down on paper, and she would get into any sort of subject and explore it and learn everything there was about it and write about it. And then, and one of the jobs she had during World War II and afterwards was actually as a propagandist for the U.S. government, for a magazine called America, which went to the Soviet Union. And one of the things she wrote about there were American slums and American architecture. And then after she left that, she got a full-time job at Architectural Forum, where her beat was the city.
And she covered a lot of cities. I
mean, she covered a lot of cities, including Baltimore.
Baltimore, Philadelphia,
Washington,
Boston,
Cleveland.
Yeah. She has been called the most influential urban thinker of all time. She's compared to the likes of Thomas Jefferson and Frederick Law Olmsted and others. One person in your book even likened this book to the paper that Luther nailed to the Schlosskirche Wittenberg in 1517. I mean, the 95 Theses. I mean, is that true? I mean, is she that? Does she loom that large on the urban planning
scene? I would
scene?
Say yes. I would say yes. On the listing that you're talking about, there were something like 100 people on the list who had contributed to our understanding of cities, and she was number one by far. I think it's the kind of thing, though, where by now, more than 50 years after Death and Life came out, it's in the air. We aren't always so conscious of it. People, architects, developers talk about a mixed-use development. The word mixed-use goes back to Jane Jacobs. The whole notion that you want to have a mixing of uses is an idea that goes back to Jane Jacobs.
You write that there's a fellow named Thomas Kuhn who coined the phrase paradigm shift mm-hmm. right around the same time that Jane Jacobs mm-hmm. Had this book. Are they related, Jane Jacobs and this notion of paradigm shift? That's a term that we throw around all the time.
Now, that's a term that goes back to Thomas Kuhn, who would be another good subject for a biography, because his book was tremendously influential, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Yeah, he coined that term, and if it applies to anyone, I'd say it applies to Jane Jacobs. That's not to say that there aren't people who came earlier who had at various times thought some of these things. But what she did in Death and Life is bring these ideas together in a palatable form that ordinary readers, as well as architects and planners, could understand.
One of her observations was, she says, there are no causes of stagnation. There are no causes of poverty. There are only causes of growth. What do you make of that?
Jane was fascinated, I think, by what you might call processes of life. One of the early stories is her father pointing to an oak tree in their garden and say, what is the purpose of that oak tree? And Jane, as a little girl, hemmed and hawed, oh, I don't know. And he said, the purpose of that tree is to live. Life itself, vibrancy, vitality, is itself good. And if we see poor neighborhoods or we see poor countries, a natural question is to ask, well, how did that happen? That's terrible. And Jane's preoccupation was saying, that's misdirected. What we need to do is look for good working models of countries and cities and neighborhoods that are working well and take our lessons from that.
Because when I read that phrase, there are no causes of stagnation and no causes of poverty, that seems to be, if she was out of step with the zeitgeist in the 1960s, she may be very much out of the step with the zeitgeist now, because people talk often about systemic inequality, systemic racism, as direct causes of poverty and inequality. So it's interesting that notion seemed to take hold. And I wonder if the current conversation we're having about inequality, you know, is taking place in that context.
I think it's probably true that one of Jane's, I wouldn't say a blind spot, but fuzzy spot, was about issues of race and ethnicity, that she tended, in writing the book, one of her editors said, you know, Jane, you really need to address some of the special problems of blacks in cities. And she resisted that. And I think her explanation was not that wasn't important, but that in this book, at this time, thinking about the nature of cities, I don't want to be waylaid. I don't want to be distracted by legitimate issues that aren't essential to the nature of cities themselves. And she may have been a little bit misdirected in that way.
She had a lot of examples of cities she thought didn't work very well, but several areas that she thought did. One was the North End in Boston, which is, I guess, the Italian, mm-hmm. near certainly the Italian section of Boston. She held that up as a paradigm in a lot of ways. Why? What makes the North End so successful?
One of the ways in which Death and Life was so radical, and radical is not an overstatement, I think, was to hold up the virtue of density, that you needed crowded cities, you needed crowded neighborhoods. And we think one of the hallmarks of poverty is, overcrowding, that's a terrible thing. And she would agree that overcrowding is a terrible thing. But that's overcrowding within individual apartments. But if you can have a neighborhood that's a very high density, as the North End was, You have, in that case, a lot of vitality, a lot of energy going into the streets and into the whole environment of that place. And the fact that you have a highly dense neighborhood is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. If you're looking at the bus system of a place like Baltimore, for example, or the transit system, I think one of the factors that undercuts it is that there simply isn't enough density in many areas of the city to support it, to vitalize. And I think that's one of the points, one point that Jane would make.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Okay, we got lots more on this. Robert Cannigal is the author of 8 books, the most recent of which we're taking up today, Eyes on the Street, The Life of Jane Jacobs. He'll be talking about it tonight at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. When we come back after a quick break, we'll be joined by Ed Guntz, a reporter for the Baltimore Brew who has covered architecture and planning in Baltimore for many years. We'll talk about the proposed development at Port Covington. Are the precepts and ideas that Jane Jacobs introduced in the 1950s still in play today as people imagine what this so-called city within a city should look like? Who's it being built for? How will it merge into the life of the adjacent neighborhoods in South Baltimore and to the rest of the cities? What are your ideas for Port Covington or any new developments in the area? If you live in the city, how come? If you're a suburbanite, why do you prefer that? You can give us a call, 410-662-8780. Drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. That's a new address, @MiddayTomHall. We're back in a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. It's Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Looking ahead to the rest of the week here on Midday. Tomorrow, Mike Rowe joins me here in Studio A. He's a Baltimore guy who's familiar to TV fans of Dirty Jobs. It's a show that he began on the Discovery Channel that most say changed the face of reality television. He's appearing at the Lyric Theater this weekend, and he'll be with us here tomorrow on Midday. And coming up Thursday, Gary Vicon, the former director of the Walters Art Museum. He'll talk about his new memoir about his years in the scholarly and sometimes shady world of art and antiquities. So if you've just joined us this afternoon, my guest is Robert Cannigal, whose latest book is a biography of the urban planner and visionary Jane Jacobs. It's called Eyes on the Street. We're also joined now by Ed Guntz, a reporter who has covered the Baltimore architecture scene for years as a reporter with the Baltimore Sun and now as a writer for the Baltimore Brew, Architects Newspaper, and the Baltimore Fishbowl. Ed, how you doing? Good to see you.
Hi, pleased to be with you with your new time slot.
Yeah, glad to be here and have you with us as well. So what's your take on Jane Jacobs? I mean, this is a subject you know a good bit about, perhaps not as much as Robert does, but is she as influential as everybody says?
Well, that was your question. And as someone who studied architecture in the 70s, she really was held up as an urban visionary and original thinker, and she got a lot of credit for ideas. What she did that was early on, she may not have been the only one, but she questioned modernism. She questioned the idea of sweeping plazas and big super blocks and so on, and to tear down historic buildings to make way for new parts of the city. Others were doing it as architectural professionals, like Robert Venturi in Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture, or Kevin Lynch in Image of the City. Some professionals were, but as a non-professional, as an ordinary citizen, she had a perspective that none of these other people had. And what Robert's book does is he explains how someone who was an ordinary housewife, mother of three, became this extraordinary writer with such a sweeping impact.
I would claim she was never an ordinary housewife, but that's another story.
Yeah.
Well, no, but I mean, she was put down as an ordinary,
yes,
as someone, a run-of-the-mill, who is this person? She didn't even go to college, that kind of thing. And yet your book explains why it was her that had certain things in her background that made her the perfect person who really did have eyes on the street.
If you'd like to join us this afternoon, you can give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send me a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. We're talking about Jane Jacobs, the urban planner and visionary. So, Robert, in your book, you write that she has sort of four things that she lists as important for the success of a city. A couple of them Ed just alluded to: mixed primary uses, short blocks, not big, long, super blocks, buildings of various ages, including old ones. So she was not a person that says tear it all down and start from scratch. And then, as you mentioned earlier, dense concentrations of people. She likens cities to a complex dance. And that's interesting to me, that her notion of cities included the people walking up and down the street. That constant movement was a fundamental thing for her.
Probably the most famous couple of paragraphs in the book, in her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, was what she called the ballet of the sidewalk, the ballet of the street, where she recounted a day in the life of her neighborhood almost through the 24 hours, and where people were constantly coming and going. New people were appearing, you know, at first, you know, they're taking away the trash barrels, and then the children are coming to school and so on. And in that ballet, she saw a kind of beauty, an urban beauty that was very different from what a suburbanite, for example, would think of as beauty, but that it had its own beauty within it.
Cities have interactions that are unavoidable, and she contended that people move to the suburbs to avoid those interactions in great measure. I mean, do you think that's a fair assessment of what she was thinking, and do you think that's true?
What she espoused before Jim Rouse said cities are fun, she said it's okay for cities to be messy. It's okay for cities to be chaotic. It's okay for them to be gritty. They don't all have to be clean and sterile and antiseptic. In fact, it's bad for too much sterility. That was a way of looking at cities that was counter to the thoughts of the time when there were riots and I guess in 61 the riots of the Martin Luther King era hadn't happened, but this was before they tore down Grand Central Station in New York City. She advocated
Pennsylvania Station, yeah.
In Pennsylvania Station, she advocated to save the best of the old buildings in cities,
but not solely from the point of view of preservation. That was certainly a big part of it. But she saw a place for old buildings in and of themselves, that when the rents come down far enough, then groups or entities or institutions or clubs can finally find a place to pay that's cheap enough to pay the rent. And that in itself has the effect of making the city more various.
That's Robert Canigal. His new book is called Eyes on the Street, The Life of Jane Jacobs. Ed Guntz from the Baltimore Brew and the Baltimore Fishbowl and Architecture Newspaper is here as well. It's midday on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. So it's interesting. She was thinking about cities in new ways and taking in new dimensions of how you conceive what a city should be. We have an email from Ed from Essex, and he says, for example, Ed, in planning Port Covington, has anyone given thought to climate change and to rising sea levels? Is this the kind of thing that we should now be incorporating into our conception of new development like Port Covington?
Well, the answer is yes. And the city requires that to some degree with its Office of Sustainability and so on. But the planners for Port Covington in particular, the team has a number of experts who look at the water side as well as the land side and the effect of the rising sea levels and what needs to be done to make the parks along the edge usable way into the future. That's part of what they have looked at.
I know some places like in Miami, when they talk about developing Miami now, I mean, they're very, very concerned about, you know, the erosion and the fact that, in not too many years, Miami's going to be largely underwater.
And same with the southern tip of Manhattan. I mean, there's a large project to change the contours of that to prevent rising sea levels.
Jane Jacobs talks about the dishonest mask of pretended order. I love that notion because she was very comfortable with the somewhat chaotic, character of cities and busy, hustling, bustling city streets.
She saw that as a positive good, not merely that she was comfortable with it. She saw that as a positive good, and I think that was true in her home as well. And the street on which she lived was not a perfect, sweet, pretty, orderly place. Can I address what we were talking about just a second ago on this environmental aspect? I don't think Jane, it's always a mistake to try to predict what Jane would have said in a particular situation. But I think the effect of suburbs and the fact that people are driving to them and pouring carbon into the air has an environmental effect that people may not always think about. And I think Jane would probably agree that if you care about the environment and if you care about the countryside, then you need to make for stronger cities.
She thought about cars in the city also, and she famously rode a bicycle to work herself. They had a car, but she rode her bicycle everywhere.
Of course, we've been thinking a lot about Port Covington. Last night, the city council sort of did the final vote to send the bill creating the TIF, the bonds for the infrastructure of Port Covington. That will go to Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake's desk. In the next few days, she'll sign it next week. We have a tweet from Barbara Samuels, who's from the ACLU of Maryland. She opposed, and their organization opposed, the Port Covington development. She says, Jane Jacobs is rolling in her grave over Port Covington. She tried to warn against big projects creating faux neighborhoods. What's your reaction to that, Ed Guns?
One of the characteristics of Port Covington is it is primarily all new construction with a few existing buildings. It is starting with a blank slate, and that is not something that Jane Jacobs advocated for or generally worked in. She liked layers of cities. She thought the richness and diversity was what made a city valuable, and that was a positive thing. And in terms of what Port Covington is doing, just by the nature of the fact that it's changing from industrial use to a more mixed use, commercial use, they are essentially building all new buildings all at the same period or over a period of 20 years. And it's harder to build in that sense of diversity and mixture and chaos and grittiness and so on.
So, Robert, I mean, knowing what you know about Jane Jacobs, she once said that she was not all that concerned with how streets looked, not unless they were interesting and humane. What does she mean about that? And couldn't we create streets from scratch that are interesting and humane?
As Ed has said, I think Jane was always leery of too much money and too much energy and too much being funneled into one project all at one time. I think she termed catastrophic money, catastrophic levels of financing.
Yeah, she was an incrementalist. She thought things should have been done slowly.
That's right. On the other hand, when she got to Toronto, there was one period where she was actually defending a rather large project, Harbor City, I think it was called, that was the brainchild of her husband's employer, Ebb Zeidler. And it didn't go anywhere, as it happens. But the fact that Jane was actually in favor of a large project reminds us not to be too quick about assuming that we know what Jane would decide on something.
She was in New York for many years, and then she did move to Toronto and actually wrote the majority of her books as a Canadian resident and then later a citizen. Tell us why she moved to Toronto.
There was a war going on, the Vietnam War, and she was she was against the war, but in a more particular way, her sons were approaching draft age, and she and Bob, her husband, talked about it, and they weren't going to go to Vietnam for sure, and they certainly weren't going to enlist, and they and I and millions of other people thought it was a cruel and stupid war that was doing great harm to the world, and she and her family moved to Toronto for the sake of their children who were just approaching draft age.
Ed Guntz, she was an activist in New York, continued her activism in neighborhoods in Toronto. She was, for example, very famously opposed to Robert Moses's plan to build a highway through the village in Manhattan, in lower Manhattan, and she got it stopped. Do you find parallels between the activism that Jane Jacobs had in urban planning and the activism that we've seen on display here with the groups like the ACLU of Maryland or BUILD or Maryland Working Families, the other organizations who are at the table with Sagamore talking about what Port Covington should look like?
Well, I think there's always going to be some negative reaction or some critical assessment or critical reaction to any plan as big as either Port Covington or a Robert Moses Expressway project. And that's a healthy thing. One thing that the ACLU and some of the community groups have looked at are the non-bricks and mortar aspects of Port Covington in terms of affordable housing and job creation and job training and so on. Whereas Jane Jacobs primarily looked at the merits of a project based on the bricks and mortar and the design. And she, as Rob said earlier on, she in her book eschewed talking about race and the effects on blacks of certain projects. She didn't want to get into that in what she was writing. She wanted to keep it to the rules she had in her mind about eyes on the street and diversity and mixed use and so on.
Yeah, Robert, I mean, one of the other conversations we've been having for a long time here in Baltimore has to do with all the vacant housing there is and whether it should be torn down and turned into green space or whether they should be renovated or what should happen with it one way or the other. When it comes to gentrification, it seems to me that Jane Jacobs was not a big fan in many ways. She wrote that we need to respect, in the deepest sense, strips of chaos that have a weird wisdom of their own, not yet encompassed in our concept of urban order.
This is a pretty complicated issue because there are many neighborhoods in many cities that have been revitalized, that are coming back in Baltimore and elsewhere, that she and I and you would probably all agree is a good thing. It's when it goes crazy, when property values accelerate so quickly and people are actually forced out from their neighborhoods, that most of us would agree that we call this gentrification, that it's a bad thing. But much of the actual uptick in many neighborhoods we can possibly ascribe to the influence of Jane and her, not the direct influence, that would be unfair to say, but to the flavor of acceptance of city life that Jane set out for us.
The one thing that the Sagamore people talk about in terms of Port Covington is it is a project that is not displacing anybody. It doesn't tear down public housing. It doesn't tear down any kind of housing. But the thing that some of the local critics of the project look at is okay, it doesn't displace anybody, but who does it include? Who does it exclude by the nature of the price of any new housing?
On 88.1, it's Maryland, or it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll have more with Robert Canigal and Ed Guntz after a quick break. And give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can email us, midday@wipr.org, or send us a tweet, @midday Tom Hall. Robert Canigal's new book is called Eyes on the Street, The Life of Jane Jacobs. Stay with us.
So I decided that really, if anything was ever going to get changed, it was going to have to be changed by citizens resisting what was done to them, and by citizens understanding cities and insisting that the right things be done in their areas. You know that thing about an inert object? Well, there is nothing more inert than a bureaucracy, than a government bureau. There is nothing more inert than a planning office. It gets going in one direction, and it is never going to change of its own accord. The only way it will ever reverse itself and start in new directions, and also the legislation and all these things that go with it will begin to change, is when the planning offices and the government bureaus and the other people concerned with planning our cities get so frustrated because of resistance to them.
Jane Jacobs speaking to an audience of architects and urban planners in New York in 1962 having made a big splash with the publication of her seminal work, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday here on 88.1 WYPR. My guest this hour is Robert Cannigal, who's written a fascinating biography of Jane Jacobs called Eyes on the Street. Jacobs' book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, is a seminal work in the history of urban planning. Ed Guntz joins us as well here in Studio A. He writes about development for the Baltimore Brew, Architects Newspaper, and the Baltimore Fishbowl. He was for many years a writer at the Baltimore Sun. As we mentioned, the Baltimore City Council voted last night to approve a $660 million bond bill known as a TIF to create the infrastructure for a massive development in Port Covington. In light of the huge investment that the city and Under Armour are making in Port Covington today, we're thinking a little bit about what the overarching approach to the design of this new area should be and how it might be informed by some of the design principles suggested by Jane Jacobs more than 50 years ago. You're welcome to join us. Give us a call. 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. You could send us a tweet at midday, Tom Hall. So Robert Cannigal, she's talking about people standing up and not just taking perceived wisdom, you know, whatever the city developers tell them to do, much in the way that so many groups of activists did when the Port Covington project was first proposed. Community was incredibly important to her. She wrote a seminal article called Downtown is for People. It's amazing to me how her concept of cities as not just a bunch of buildings, but buildings with human beings rolling around in them, hadn't been thought of before her, it seems like.
Yeah, well, I think in her emphasis on local communities holding fast against large institutions, I think that was a fresher and newer idea at the time. I think in the wake of World War II, when our generals had defeated the Nazis and the Japanese, when I think scientists and experts in general were taken, you know, more seriously, that if they said it, if the experts have said it, then it must be so. And one of Jane's tremendously important contributions, even before the Vietnam War undercut our faith in the experts, was to speak up and say, well, the experts can't speak for you. They don't know what it's like to live in your neighborhood. You need to band together and respond to what is going on to you, what is happening to you.
Robert Cannigal, the author of the new book on Jane Jacobs, Eyes on the Street, The Life of Jane Jacobs. We have Peter on the line from Baltimore. He's got a comment about vacant housing. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Yes, on the bricks and mortar side, as honorable as it is to see a layered approach to the design, what I've experienced and seen, at least in some of West Baltimore and a lot of the vacant housing in Baltimore, is that it's functionally obsolete. And what other solution is there but to tear it down?
I think the question is, it's functionally obsolete by whose standards? Anything can be made, brought up to code, brought up to modern standards. It's just a matter of the cost, and is the cost justified? And the real estate values and the nature of investment, there's no market payoff for any kind of investment in certain areas of West Baltimore, especially after the riots of last year. There's other places where people are going to put their money, and that's the question. I think if you follow the Jane Jacobs philosophy, she would probably see a way to recycle, and she was an advocate of adaptive reuse of old buildings for creative mixes of new ways to occupy them.
She also spoke, I think she used the word infill, that instead of thinking with a broad brush, a whole block, tear it the hell down, you know, erase it, her tendency was to say, well, you know, this is worth saving right here. These two houses are probably not worth saving. Maybe they should be torn down. This section can be preserved. We need to think in the small. And she actually did this in the West Village. She had a housing development that was actually scattered across seven blocks, where the individual houses were interspersed, were inserted into the rest of the urban fabric.
Don from Columbia is on the line. We alluded to this opposition to the Robert Moses highway going into Lower Manhattan. Don wants to talk about that. Don, welcome to Midday.
Yes. How are you doing? Yes, I read the book about 45 years ago when I was studying architecture, and remember a lot of the basic principles she espoused, and then later found out that she had quite a combative relationship with Robert Moses. The two of those individuals were thinking and planning and designing on diametrically opposite sides of a spectrum. She was thinking very small-scale, neighborhood, community scale. He was thinking mega-large scale and trying to run major interstate highways divisibly through the city. So how much of their combative relationship actually helped build her reputation, Robert, other than just the book?
Robert Campbell, what do you think?
I think a lot of attention has been given to the Jane as David, Robert Moses as Goliath meme, I guess you'd say. And certainly that they only seem to have met once or twice, actually. But from everything that I heard, Robert Moses was very much in the air of the Jacobs household as a large figure, an enemy. And I think that was certainly one of the ways in which we remember Jane, but it should never be the only way. We need to think of her in the context of death and life as well as her other books.
And I don't think Robert Moses was originally something that prompted her to write what she wrote. I think he came along later as a boogeyman for her to fight against, because personally he was doing things that were affecting her own neighborhood. And if you look at the difference between her life in New York City and Port Covington, who is the boogeyman in Port Covington? Is there a Robert Moses parallel here in Baltimore? And I'm not sure what the answer would be. The city isn't coming in and imposing something on Port Covington the way Robert Moses was coming in and imposing something on Lower Manhattan that could instantly be turned off if enough people protested it. In this case, there was a private developer who had an initiative that the city supported or wanted to support, and people questioned it and so on. But it's not the same as a Robert Moses situation.
Sure. And Robert Cantigal, I mean, some of her decisions perhaps don't hold up, or some of the positions she took don't hold up in light of history. For example, she opposed the development of Lincoln Center because it was going to displace so many people who lived there. But I think probably, you know, nowadays most New Yorkers and people who visit Manhattan think that, you know, that mm-hmm. section of Broadway is a good thing.
I think that's probably true. But I also think that the people, as I recall, you'll correct me, one of you will, that there was recently a fairly significant redesign of the Lincoln Center complex to make it sew it into the adjacent streets more effectively and to make it more part of the city. And I think one of the things that she was against was that here Lincoln Center stood as this center apart, completely and forever apart from the rest of the city, and that was not a good thing.
And that was consistent with her questioning of single use, no matter what it was, if it was all housing, if it's all office, if it's all industrial, or if it's even all arts, whereas all arts could be a very good thing for Manhattan.
Donald from Baltimore has a comment about urban renewal being successful in a couple of other places. Donald, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I have a... Is it ready now? Go.
Yeah, you're on Midday.
Okay.
Glad to hear from
you. You're on.
I'm Don Sickler. I worked on two very large projects in the city. One in Detroit, in which the city had torn down a big area and didn't know what to do with it. But we finally turned it into housing where the school was included in it and other things. There was a church nearby and you could walk to the downtown. In fact, one of the senators from Michigan lives in the project.
Mr. Sickler worked on the One Charles Center project with Mies van der Rohe, and that Charles Center even though it was a mega project, a 33-block renewal project, Jane Jacobs liked that more than she liked certain other projects, according to Robert's book. And yeah. and Donald Sickler is one of the heroes in Baltimore. He also helped save the Rotunda building on 41st Street.
Well, Mr. Sickler, thank you so much for your call. And Robert Cantigal, I mean, it sounds like she was not, you know, rigidly orthodox in everything she
Jane thought. Wasn't rigidly orthodox about anything. Her politics, her social views, even her closest friends were always careful not to figure they knew how Jane would respond to a particular local issue or a particular development or anything.
The new urbanists in America who advocate smaller scale development and trying to make buildings look traditional and everything have tried to adopt her in a way of saying that Jane Jacobs would have liked what new urbanism. And Jane Jacobs didn't agree with that. She didn't want to be adopted. She didn't want any group, any faction to ask for her imprimatur, you know?
I'm interested in the question that one of the folks you quote in your book, Robert, he says that she, Jane Jacobs, asked the question, what are cities good for? And the answer is they're good for ideas. Ideas get put into use. They arise from different cultures and bodies of knowledge meeting each other. So it's that density business.
The density and the mixing. And if you have people secreted away in their own little corners of the world, separate from everybody, and maybe going from one place to another by car and never encountering other people in other walks of life, in other worlds, it's kind of a sterility that doesn't lead to the best ideas.
But when I read that, I thought of all people, Franz Joseph Haydn, the great composer.
Tell us.
And because in my other life, I'm a musician. Yeah. So Haydn was under the employ of the Esterházy family, and they had this palace out in the middle of nowhere, and they didn't spend very much time in Vienna, in the city. So Haydn's out there in Esterházy in the boonies for months and months and months at a time, for years and years and years. And he said at the end of his life, you know, it ended up being a good thing because I had to be original. He was sort of uninfluenced by everybody going, doing all that other stuff in, you know, in downtown in Vienna. And I wonder if there's, you know, a certain creativity that does come from isolation.
I think there's a place for solitude and isolation in any creative endeavor. It has to be. And there's also a place for rubbing up against other people and other people's ideas.
And Ed Gantz, what do we know at the moment about what the design of Port Covington is going to look like? It's in the very early stages, obviously, but do we have any hints as to what this new thing is going to feel like and look like?
Yes. And I don't know that it is in the early stages entirely. I mean, they've been working on it for more than a year, and there have been numerous meetings with the city. And the lead architect for the Under Armour headquarters portion is one of the top architects in the country. It's not anyone who's trendy. It's not anyone who is too conservative.
Yeah, that's good. So at this stage, you're somewhat sanguine then. That's good to know. Yeah,
and they're from Scranton, just like Jane Jacobs.
There you go. Ed Gantz writes about design and development for the Baltimore Brew, the Architect's newspaper, and the Baltimore Fishbowl. We'll have linked to some of Ed's stories on our website, wipr.org/midday. Robert Cantigal is the author of the new biography of Jane Jacobs. It's called Eyes on the Street, The Life of Jane Jacobs. You can meet Robert Cantigal tonight at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore. He'll be talking about and signing copies of his book starting at 7 o'clock. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you. I appreciate it, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
That'll do it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, TV reality show host and pitchman Mike Rowe will be here to talk about the foundation that he's started to connect people with skilled jobs. There's a skills gap in the United States. There are lots of professions with lots of open positions, but very few people skilled enough to take them. Mike's trying to do something about that, and he'll tell us about it tomorrow on midday, noon to 1 here on 88.1. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guest today. Joe Squared serves cold-fired pizza, a risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Don't forget to catch Sheila Cast on her new show, On the Record, tomorrow at 9:30. And coming up in just a few minutes, the next installment of Aaron Henkin and Wendell Patrick's Out of the Blocks. That's next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us. Have a great day.